This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about the nurse staffing shortage and how it's impacting our nurses and hospitals across the state. But first, we'll talk about what's going on at nursing schools right now with Robin Newhouse, Dean of the IU School of Nursing on the IUPUI campus. Welcome, Robin.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
What does the nursing curriculum typically look like for IU nursing students prior to the pandemic, let's say?
So prior to the pandemic, we admitted students in their second year, so they've had their prerequisites, and they spend 3 years with us, a full-time study in the undergraduate program until they graduate. Those curriculum includes both didactic, which gives them the basis that they need for anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, et cetera, as well as clinical practice in multiple settings, both in hospitals and community settings. So that would be the typical university experience for undergraduate registered nurses.
Well, how has the pandemic changed the way nursing students are taught?
Well, I think initially the shock of being able to teach the program virtually was really important to us. So immediately last March in 2020, when we knew that being virtual would be the right thing to do to protect the health of our students, faculty, and staff, we were very well suited, actually, because many of our faculty over decades have been edge runners in the area of online and virtual education. So many of us had some substantial skills in being able to deliver education in that way. So when I think of a virtual education, and we use the word online, we may be talking about asynchronous, where you are taking a course that might have videos, teaching learning strategies, cases that you need to respond to, but you're not interacting with a faculty member. But it also includes a synchronous mechanism by which sometimes it's just like being in a classroom where lectures are delivered, there's interactions, there are strategies that are employed to discuss a case or a method or a specific area of study. And it's interactive, and the exams also can be delivered online, but you still have that interactive experiences. So we had a blend of those kinds of opportunities for students, and that did change pretty abruptly. And I would also say that many students had not had any exposure to online learning because they have come from high school, they have had in-person courses in their first year, and here they are in nursing school, which is a clinical practice, and they are now facing some online learning. So it was new for them too. So I would say that we were very careful to make sure that we attended to the student experience, that we talked together as faculty so that we planned high quality delivery of education. We always look to our program outcomes and assure that our program outcomes are embedded in the teaching learning strategy and objectives in each course. So we were very careful to assure that we were giving them the education, both the knowledge and the practice experience that they needed to graduate as a nurse. And that also included simulation experiences as well, and other forms of online learning.
Well, we have a clip from Taylor Blankenhorn, a nursing student from IUPUC, talking about how clinicals are going for her.
As far as COVID goes, we're not really doing a whole lot of hands-on with patients, but it definitely affects the learning experience, I'd say, especially as many COVID patients that are coming in right now, numbers are just going up. So not having that hands-on experience with certain patients because of COVID is unfortunate.
When it comes to clinicals and not having hands-on experience due to COVID, what does this mean for the future of how students are taught? Does it have any effect on what they're learning?
Interestingly enough, there have been studies over time about the use of simulation as a substitute or a complement of clinical learning. And there are studies that support that up to 50% of the clinicals could be actually taught by simulation. You've got to remember that simulation is not just a mannequin in a room anymore. We have high fidelity simulation who respond, who can react, that can be tailored to provide different simulations within that experience. So not only did our students have the didactic, but they also had some high fidelity simulation experiences, as well as clinicals. Clinicals were prohibited for a while when the surges were high, but we also have to remember that we were able to provide clinical experiences over time as well. So it wasn't as if during that period of time that we needed to assure that all of the hospitals were caring first and foremost for the patients, and the personal protective equipment was being provided to the people that were providing clinical care. I think once things stabilized and we were able to open up to make sure that the students got the clinical experience as well. So our students were very well prepared actually for the clinical environment. We got good feedback. We have high pass rates for the licensing exam as well. So we actually saw that although it wasn't what we wanted to do, which, you know, we wanted that the clinicals and the in-person experiences for our students, we really desired for them to be the same as they were when we were in person. But knowing that the safe way to educate really became the primary motive in this work, and students did well.
The high fidelity simulations definitely caught my attention. Because back in the day when I was in school, I remember folks that were taking medical or nursing tracks had actors, I think, that would work with them. So that's really interesting to be able to have a simulation that can kind of go through the steps.
Yes, well, you're right. We have standardized patients too. So I think that is another alternative, but when we're trying to make sure that we are, we have students that are completely protected, that they have the mask and the gowns that they need in all of these experiences, we were very much attending to making sure we were spaced correctly and that we were applying all of the safe practices that we possibly could, and did not introduce any situations where there were large bodies of people together in a small space.
Well, it sounds like these nursing students are sort of at the forefront of something brand new, being trained during a pandemic and sort of learning how to navigate that. Would you say that's something they're experiencing?
I think so. This is something that they'll have a story to tell about their experience while they were in nursing school and how things shifted very quickly, and wearing masks in the classroom as well as in the environment. And I think the other thing that's happened is that the governor created an executive order where our students that graduated during the pandemic could apply for a temporary license and actually be hired directly, which actually worked very well too. So there are things that happen that the students rose to that experience to serve and get started with their career early in organizations where they plan to work in the future. So I think there were some pretty innovative things that happened.
With innovation, there's also been talk of shortages, nursing shortages, or academia shortages of faculty. Are you seeing that at all?
So I would say nationally, yes. Nationally, we have seen the faculty shortage. And I would say the American Association of Colleges of Nursing did some surveys in 2019, 2020, and did find that number one, nursing schools were turning away a large amount of students. And second of all, that there were over 1,600 faculty vacancies in about 900 schools. So that was prevalent. I would say that we at IU are not at this time experiencing a faculty shortage. We have certainly different faculty that work clinically sometimes than those that are working didactically, but the faculty shortage is real, and part of it is because there are not as many people coming into education as a professional career, and part of it is due to a salary differentiation, I would say, because in clinical practice, nurses have higher salaries and they tend to be lower in the academic environment. So that's one thing. And I think the other major contributing factor is age. So many of the faculty are getting older and they're retiring. So these are factors that we're seeing, but nonetheless, others, we are finding that we have people that would like some kinds of joint appointments for faculty, and they'll stay in clinical for a period of time. We have models where people would like to be faculty and maybe do one day a week in the clinical environment. So we're starting to see some innovative models, and certainly are working with any innovative solution that we can possibly find. But yeah, yes, you're right. I think the nation has experienced a decrease in people that are coming into the academic environment. And I think those are the two major factors, the money and the aging of our faculty, that have been the major contributors.
Well, we have another clip from Taylor Blankenhorn, a nursing student from IUPUC, talking about her future.
I've kind of been in the nursing like career for a while, so it's definitely my passion and what I want to do. But I'd say COVID's kind of taken a toll on everyone, but I'm hopeful and I'm sticking with it.
And again, that was Taylor Blankenhorn, a nursing student from IUPUC, talking about her future. We'll be back after a quick break with Robin Newhouse, Dean of the IU School of Nursing on the IUPUI campus. We're talking about the nurse staffing shortage and the impact of the pandemic on hospitals right now. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit some of our favorite conversations this past week. Now we go back to our conversation on the nursing shortage in academia and on the front lines. We're continuing our conversation with Robin Newhouse, the dean of the IU School of Nursing on the IUPUI campus. Robin, are you hopeful that the shortage of nurses and faculty can be fixed in the near future?
I am certain that together we can figure this out. There's a lot more to a nurse than a number. So when we think about the nursing shortage, I think there are a lot of additional questions we've got to ask. It's not just, do we have the bolus of nursing? Can we train more nurses? But we've got to think about these other kinds of factors, which include, are we allowing nurses to work to the full scope of their practice? That's advanced practice nurses and nurses that are baccalaureate nurses. How will we deploy nurses to focus on some of the stickiest issues we're facing in our community around equity, our differences in treatment? How can we deploy nurses to work at the full scope of their responsibility in all settings, both the community setting and the hospital setting? How can we create workplaces where nurses want to stay in place and progress throughout a career in nursing? How can we set up these? I could talk for probably all day about how we can solve this problem. These are known factors. And I think when we hear about the nursing shortage and think that a nurse can be counted, there is so much science and so much skill and so much analysis and critical thinking that a nurse has when they leave our programs, that they are really ready to do far more than nursing is doing now. So I think we have to create a new vision together and a new future together. And it's going to take us all and us to partner with our new evolving nurses and nurse leaders about how we can create a space and a place for nursing to grow and nursing to contribute. It only takes an admission to the intensive care unit to see how the registered nurses are assessing, are planning, are relieving symptoms, are working with families to understand how important a nurse is. And that's just not in the critical care setting, but I would say if you see the news stories that they're very often, that's the setting they're in. But it's also on medical surgical floors. Nurses have a big responsibility for alleviation of symptoms, for decreasing risk, decreasing injury, and advocating for patients. There's a science and an art to it, and we need to free nursing to work to their full scope of responsibility. And I think it's not just in education and creating nurses, but it's in the clinical arena too. And I'll just mention that during the pandemic, we did a survey of 16 Midwest hospitals, over 6,000 nurses, to ask them about what they were experiencing in the clinical environment. And, you know, they were experiencing innovations. They were experiencing innovations about personal protective equipment, how to manage them, how to use them, how to sort of have some efficiency in donning all of the protective equipment they were using. They had ideas about how to ensure a safer space, how to conserve supplies, how to provide patient and family education, for example, and team member communications. So there is so much innovation that's happening now, both in the clinical arena. These nurses are on their feet, standing and innovating every moment of the day. So I think that although we think about the pandemic and we think about some of the stress that all have encountered during the pandemic, the innovative minds of nurses, both in the clinical environment and in the academic environment, are both a signal of we will be champions in nursing and champions certainly for the provision of clinical care and patients. And there's lots of innovation that's going on, even at this very difficult time.
Thank you so much for joining us. Robin Newhouse is the dean of the IU School of Nursing on the IUPUI campus. We're talking today about the field of nursing and how it's been hit by the pandemic, and in particular, the nursing shortage we've been hearing about. With us now are Amy Pettit, Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schneck Medical Center in Seymour, and Rachel Spaulding, Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
Amy, how long has this shortage been going on? It sounds like it's something fairly recent due to the pandemic, but was it something that was already happening?
I think when you look at the information that's provided nationwide, there has always been some form of a nursing shortage. So when you look at individuals who are in the field, those individuals who may be retiring or maybe wanting to get out of direct patient care areas, we can see and map out that we're not producing enough nurses in academia in order to fill those open gaps. What COVID and the pandemic has done is that it has sped up that process and caused it to be much more prevalent.
And Rachel, what are some of the reasons we're seeing a nursing shortage aside from folks not going into academia to teach? Is there anything else?
Yeah. So, Amy talked about nursing shortage existed before the COVID pandemic. Nursing shortage has always been at the forefront of most conferences and topics surrounding the nursing profession for some time. And, you know, we've always had, issues with, as Amy mentioned, we have an aging workforce. So the, average age of a nurse, particularly in Indiana and around the nation, is around 49 years of age. And so, we've had this onslaught of retirement that's happened, and COVID-19 has accelerated those early retirements. And also we've, really struggled to have enough faculty nationwide in order to increase the class sizes. And, in 2020, it's been estimated that over 80,000 qualified nursing school applicants have been turned away from programs because we don't have enough faculty to teach. And there's been some issues with class sizes across the country. So this has been an ongoing issue. But of course, the COVID-19 pandemic has just accelerated those issues.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like the pandemic just made things worse that were already kind of on that trajectory. Well, Amy, what are some of the biggest impacts you've seen the shortage have on hospitals right now?
I think currently, especially with the Delta variant that has really looked at increasing the prevalence of COVID positive patients in our regions and throughout the state. What we are seeing is that a lot of organizations are having to go on diversion where they just don't have beds. And it's not that they don't have beds. They don't have staff a lot of times to be able to staff those rooms. Organizations and healthcare organizations are going on diversion. So we are having difficulty transferring people to a higher level of care. So that's creating more wait times, having to cancel surgeries or even clinic appointments at different times throughout the pandemic. All of those things impact the general health of our population, because if you're not seeking preventative care, then it could be that you're putting off problems into the future that only make those problems worse. So all of that has been impacted.
And Rachel, what does an understaffed shift look like for our listeners to sort of put themselves in the shoes of these nurses?
Yeah, and Amy said it very well, is that we're continuing to see high numbers of patients that need medical care for COVID or COVID-like symptoms. And then, we see the volume data that suggests we're seeing similar volumes to pre-pandemic surge. And it doesn't represent the fact that hospitals across the state and across the country, they're operating with less staff while seeing an increasing number of COVID admissions that have very high acuity. And when we say high acuity, that means the resources required to care for those patients have gone up significantly because their severity of illness has gone up. And so what that does is that really requires staff in all professions, particularly nursing, that all disciplines, that we're having to give each patient more time, more of our assessment skills, our critical thinking skills, everything that we need to be able to ensure we're giving them high quality care. And so when you don't have the ideal number of nurses needed to care for a large number of patients that have very high acuity, like Amy said, it's not that we necessarily don't have physical capacity, but our resource capacity has changed, and therefore we can't really accept more patients. And so that does put more stress on staff at the bedside, because they have such a high expectation of the care they want to provide on each shift, and they're doing everything they can to meet that, and that can become very stressful.
I mean, yeah, that's got to be tough, knowing that you want to provide all the help that you can, but the resources just aren't there.
Absolutely.
Well, we have a clip from Jennifer Holtman, a registered nurse working in critical care at Schneck Medical Center, who tells us about the most challenging experience for her working during the pandemic. Let's take a listen.
Well, probably the most challenging thing for me was I was the surgery nurse for multiple years. And when COVID happened, I volunteered to come back out to the floors, ended up in the ICU, and had about 2 days of training trying to learn how to operate different equipment and vents. So that was probably the most challenging thing for me, stepping out into a different area and having to learn something completely different that was not something I had ever dealt with before.
Amy, is this something a lot of nurses have had to experience, particularly during the pandemic, having to sort of expand their horizon?
Absolutely. In fact, with the higher numbers of COVID that we're seeing right now with this second surge, we're redeploying nurses from many different departments. You know, one of the great things that I always loved about nursing is that as a nurse, I can work in a lot of different departments. I could be front-facing patients in the medical, surgical, or critical care areas. I could be a nurse in IT, or I could be in a physician clinic. But with these increasing number of patients, and again, with the higher level of acuity, we're having to go and get those people that have moved on and advanced their career in other areas, and we're bringing them back to the patient bedside. So yes, we are absolutely seeing this very frequently within our organizations.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Well, Amy, just to sort of follow up a little bit more on this, what is happening at your hospital right now? Are you seeing the effects firsthand?
Yes, we absolutely are seeing the effects firsthand. We have not only are things opening back up and people getting out and getting back to normal, so you have all of the typical patients that you would have, but with this surge, and according to the Indiana Department of Health statistics, we won't peak with the second surge until the end of September. We are already seeing about half of the patients that are hospitalized with COVID. About half of them have COVID, and so the increased volumes are playing a toll. We are even pulling and offering office staff and other employees who work throughout the organization to come and learn how to be support staff for nurses so that we can get nurses to really focus on those patients. We are doing that every single shift.
Rachel, what about you, the hospital you're working at? How has the shortage affected your hospital specifically?
Yeah, very similar to Amy. We are seeing high acuity, like we talked about. That means people requiring more resources. And, you know, nurses have experienced moral distress. And what moral distress is, it's that gap between what you want to do, but not having the resources or things being out of our control to be able to really follow through on what we want to do. And that's been really why we've seen, staff and nurses in particular leave the bedside. But what we can do is, like Amy talked about, we are taking staff from all over various clinical areas and pulling them into the inpatient setting for that direct patient care. And also, you know, we created a program called the Support Buddy Program, and that's where all staff across the hospital have an opportunity to fill out a profile to say, these are the skill levels I have, or these are the skill levels I need, so that I can be helpful to my bedside caregivers and really step in and be able to help them out during their shift. And they have just been really a great, phenomenal support, not only of helping facilitate clinical care, but also providing moral and emotional support to our staff, which is so important right now, and the well-being of our nursing staff. But I think what we need for the public to understand is that we're doing the very best we can. And there really is a national crisis with nursing shortage. And we really have to speak up about what the short-term and long-term implications are, and what are some of the interventions that we can ask legislators and others to really step forward and help us with this moving forward.
Well, speaking of the national crisis, I know the American Nurses Association urged the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services last week to declare this nursing shortage a national crisis. Amy, what does that mean if it becomes labeled officially as a national crisis, or has it been?
I don't believe it has been at this point, but I think what that means for nurses is that there could be some opportunity to really support the work that the nurse does. I think we have to remember that we can look at this in a broad spectrum, and you can look at not only nursing faculty, that it might be that, you know, Dr. or Dean Newhouse talked about the salary differential earlier in the program. And when you talk about that salary differential, having this declared an emergency could mean that that gap could close. I currently teach at IUPUC in Columbus, and the reason I teach nurses is because I need nurses and they need faculty. So the shortage is real. And I have quite a few of my staff that are also trying to teach while managing full-time jobs here in healthcare. And again, we're doing this because we know how important it is that we graduate these new nurses so that they can come and join us in the field. So I think that's one area. The second area that can be looked at is really the loan payback. I think there's a great opportunity to have some type of a loan forgiveness for nurses when they graduate. If they work in direct patient care or in the nursing field for an extended period of time, then what can happen is there could be some form of loan forgiveness if this were to be declared a national emergency.
And before we head to break real quick, Rachel, what are hospitals like right now, aside from the shortage? Are they seeing anything else that would be cause for concern?
Yes, I think one of the things that are major causes for concern is that across Indiana and across the country, we are doing our very best to meet the needs of our communities and all that come to us. And, you know, we, from a capacity standpoint, our resources are tapped out. And what Amy talked about, diversion, you know, a lot of times we'll go on diversion saying, you know, right now we can accept patients because we've met our capacity from a resource standpoint. And right now you'll notice across the state and across the country, a lot of hospitals are on diversion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Rachel Spaulding, Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes, and Amy Pettit, Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schneck Medical Center in Seymour. It's the Friday Recap, where we revisit all of our favorite conversations this past week. Coming up, we'll hear more about working from home. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Working remotely became the big thing of 2020. And then this year, companies started talking about a return to the office, maybe part-time or full-time by the fall. Then COVID cases started to go up again with the Delta variant. And it almost feels like Groundhog Day. Are we back where we started? And why don't some employers just make the permanent decision to give their employees the choice to be fully remote? Well, our next guest is going to help us navigate this topic and understand what's at stake for companies and employees. Rebecca Ellis is an engagement executive with Align Org Solutions. Rebecca, it's great to have you back with us.
Excellent. Thank you for having me, Miriam.
Well, Rebecca, what has been the toughest thing for employers this past year and a half when it comes to the constantly changing CDC guidelines?
I think it is just that, Miriam, that they have been constantly changing. Just when we start to feel like things are stable enough to make plans and communicate those to our employee base, a new thing happens, like the Delta variant, making us reconsider those aspects. And it has really created a lot of volatility for our clients and for local employers.
Yeah, I mean, just when people thought they were going back to the office, we see this Delta variant. Some companies have begun mandating vaccinations for the employees. Other organizations have decided to make working from home a permanent solution. Why is it so hard for some companies to just come up with a policy and stick to it rather than continuing the whiplash of the back and forth?
I just think no one wants to be an outlier. I think most leaders are kind of taking the temperature of what's happening around them, either in their geography or in their industry. And no one wants to be the first to make a call that ends up being very unpopular. Just in recent news, the last couple of days, we've seen such happen with Google. Google has said you don't have to return to the office, but if you don't, you very well may have to take a pay cut. And that has blown up, been quite a viral story in the last couple of days. And so I think most leaders want to just kind of see what the quote unquote new normal will be and try to be as much in line with that as possible. We are just still at a point where talent is such a scarcity that no one wants to put themselves on the short end of being able to hire the best and brightest.
Well, I would think that remote work would enable companies to be able to reach out further than just their location.
It absolutely would. And so I think those that are willing to be more open and progressive to a remote work culture and environment are absolutely going to have the upper hand, especially when it comes to rather difficult roles to fill, like cybersecurity, as an example. When I've talked with my peers here in the last week, many of them actually are still going ahead with their plans to return to the office. About a third of the folks that I talked with said they're going to go right ahead as planned, regardless of this Delta variant. But I have another third who said, you know what, we're never going back. We're remote full time. And I think that's encouraging, especially I think as we talked last time, Indiana in our region has really been a laggard in this idea of working from home full time, where the coast have had to adopt it maybe earlier because of perhaps the nature of the work, in some cases more digital, but also because of the commutes that they suffer through that we have the advantage of not having so bad here in Indiana.
Do you see Indiana coming on board with stuff? I mean, I know that there have been some tech companies that have come to the area, so I would imagine that things are going to, I don't know, modernize. I don't know if that's the right word.
I absolutely do. I've definitely seen shifts in thinking. I have a CEO friend who would have said a year and a half ago, absolutely, we need to be in the office to get work done. And now he's one of the last wanting to go back himself. And so even folks are surprising themselves in that. And I do think that there have been shifts that will be long term for us. And I hope that we, you know, become more middle of the pack. I don't know we'll ever be the most progressive, but we're definitely not the laggards anymore, which is really encouraging. There is a lot of incredible talent here in Indiana and folks willing to relocate here as well because of our low cost of living. But I love the idea that we are thinking beyond Indiana for talent as well, because that really helps us increase our diversity, which may just not be completely available here if we're only thinking our own geography or region.
Well, there's also been talk about hybrid solutions where you can go in once a week or something like that. Do you think that that is something that will become the new way of doing work, or is that a setup for failure?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, Miriam. In the third of my peer group who are returning to the office, half of them are going back full-time and half of them are going back hybrid. And I do think the hybrid model will end up increasing in popularity over time. I do think it's an interesting dilemma in that if the main reason we're trying to be more spaced or distance is because of a virus, the hybrid model is organically starting to create a lot of big waves of people in the office and then very small participation in the office. So what happens is you leave it up to a work team to be in the office 1 to 2 days a week. The folks who do work adjacent or collaboratively with them also want to be in the office those 1 or 2 days. And before you know it, it's snowballed to everyone's in on those 2 days, which, by the way, are usually not Monday and Friday. And then the office is empty the rest of the time. And so in terms of viral load and what we're trying to do around distancing, it is going to work against us when things like the Delta variant come into play.
If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking about the future of remote work and getting companies on board with Rebecca Ellis, an engagement executive with Align Org Solutions. Rebecca, speaking of the tech companies, you know, many folks think remote work is their thing, that's fine, but this job or this particular field doesn't lend itself to that. How can folks change their employer's mind and get them on board with remote work?
Yeah, so I think we had the opportunity to really put a lot of different types of work to the test when we were absolutely not allowed to be in the offices with the full quarantines and full social distancing. And so hopefully that has opened our minds. I think the ones that have probably the most difficulty making the case are areas like manufacturing or healthcare, where you literally have to be present at the job site in order to get the work done. In those cases, I've seen clients often less likely to let a person say in finance or HR, really not that at the point of work delivery type of role, also have flexibility while others don't. And so I think it's a tough thing to manage there. Generally speaking, we have certainly types of work that can be done remote. And I think we've proven with the work that's happened in the last year that it's probably more tasks than we actually assumed it could be. And even just the digitalization of processes and things that we've innovated on have led us to a point where you really don't need to be in the office to do a lot of the work that was traditionally done on site.
Right. I mean, we have so much technology at our hands now that many jobs can be done sometimes more efficiently, more comfortably for some when they're not in the office. I know we've heard from listeners who've mentioned that the pandemic leveled the playing field finally for them. Maybe they have a disability and working from home is much better, but in the past they weren't listened to and now it's an option. So has the pandemic allowed employers to see that remote work isn't a problem and in fact can be an asset?
I think in many cases it has. What we know is that we actually usually get more work from a person when they're at home because they use the commute time often to dial into work, not literally like the old school ways, but get online and actually stay online too long. And so if anything, we've created almost the opposite issue around engagement, which is that we have over-delivered and over-obligated ourselves to work because it is so available in our kitchen or dining room or whatever we've converted into our workspace. And so this idea of being always on is actually a bigger epidemic and might risk more burnout and leaves than what employers are probably thinking through today. We do know, because of the Great Resignation, as they're now calling it, that employers who end up not being open to the idea of a person getting to continue to work in a flexible arrangement are very likely to lose that employee. And there have been some surveys that have come out with very high numbers, like 60% of the workforce looking for a new role if they're not able to continue in that current flexible arrangement. And particularly with females, we're already in dire straits around that. We are at a 33-year low. It has been since 1988 that we've had this little participation from a percentage perspective of women in the workplace compared to men. And they're not looking to come back anytime soon. And so that is something that employers are definitely going to have to start taking into consideration when they might be thinking it's risky to have people working from home, but the bigger risk is to not have those people if they don't make the flexible plans.
Yeah, I would say it's hard. Once you've gotten a taste, if you had the privilege and ability to work from home, it's really hard to want to go back in.
It absolutely is hard. Deloitte ran a survey and they said that 60% of women, actually more than 60%, say that they now have more responsibilities at home in particular. And, you know, when we think about traditional household task division and how that might work around kids and managing their education, which is more complicated now in a remote or hybrid learning situation, it is definitely going to be a tough situation if you don't allow them that kind of flexibility that they've gotten used to. I also fear for our pets, right? Like my own dog may need separation anxiety meds if we're now not at home full time because they're expecting that. And so there are just so many things that we've gotten used to, the flexibility of having people come do service on your home, taking a good mental health break and a walk around the block at noon that might not be as easy in the workplace. And so there would be a lot to give up. And that's why so many people are willing to put their job on the line if they're not allowed to continue working in that flexible way.
What do you think about our society that we fear change and feel like we have to go into an office and go through a commute to seem productive?
It's a really good question. I think it's just what we've always known, right? The status quo in the comfort zone. We always feel more comfortable with what we have experienced and what we know versus what the unknown could be. But again, we were thrown into this experiment, and I think we've proven in nearly every case that we can survive without being in that traditional workplace. And so I don't think those fears of the unknown are as fair now that we've had a chance to run that experiment. Again, I would put it in the risk benefits kind of categorization, trying to figure out, is it really worth trying to get back to quote unquote normal, considering what you might lose in that move?
I know you mentioned some of the drawbacks of remote work were just working too much. And I don't want to sound like I'm just tooting the horn for remote work selfishly for myself here. But are there any other drawbacks that you can think of?
So I actually would probably continue down more of your line of thinking. I think there are more drawbacks of getting back into a commute and back into a workplace. In particular, there is more control for people specifically who are marginalized or maybe less of a majority population in a workplace where they can remove themselves from situations that might be aggressive, microaggressions, and things like that, and better able to kind of craft who they interact with and how they interact. Where in the office, that proverbial water cooler is not always friendly to our marginalized populations. And specifically, now that we have so many topics that we're rather polarized around, we have a lot of folks who are quite nervous about what those organic conversations could look like. And so I definitely would still suggest that we have organic conversations and that we get to know people rather authentically. But I do think working from home gives folks a little more control or agency around those conversations and how they're treated in the workplace.
I would hope that hopefully this pandemic comes to an end and we have the remote work option, because I feel like then you can travel and see the world and just experience so many different things while still working.
Absolutely. I had a coworker who traveled a couple of weeks up to see family in Canada and was able to just, you know, really kind of unplug for sure, but also not miss a beat, because it is very typical now that our work gets done remote. Another former colleague just worked in Cabo in Mexico for a week. And again, you know, I wouldn't recommend always working through a holiday, but if your intent is to go work remote somewhere anyway, then why not work remote in a place like Cabo? And so I do love that flexibility. And even just the way that you spend your work day, I think now there's a lot more flexibility around, you know, today's back to school for a lot of folks. So we put our son on the bus, and then when he gets off here in an hour or so, you know, I'll be able to unplug for a bit, have a conversation. Where if I were in the office, I would probably not have thought to leave a couple hours early to be home and have that download and the conversation about how the first day of school went. And so it's just that work-life integration, how we better blend things together, that I don't think folks want to give up. And if part of that means I get to go work for a month in a foreign country or a different city or state, I think all the more to it. Many people, in fact, most that I know, are still delivering at or above expectations in doing so. And so there's not a big trade-off from that perspective.
I see it also as a great mental health break, just being able to put yourself in different areas, you know, getting a little fresh air, going to the beach, doing your work, just to kind of reset a little bit rather than the same monotonous schedule every day.
Absolutely. I think there are tremendous self-care type of benefits. There's been a lot of research over the years of just planning a vacation alone gives you mental health benefits, not even the actual act of being on the vacation, but just knowing that you have something to look forward to has a lift there as well. So I absolutely agree with you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Rebecca Ellis, Engagement Executive with Align.org Solutions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Miriam.
And that wraps it up for this week's edition of the Friday Recap. We hope you enjoyed the program. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. You can always reach out to us via social media or give us a call at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.